You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 260. It was a decisive win this week for Dr. Carneiro. We look at the treatment of women in sport and the media. Hurrah! The European Football Championship is finally here. Oh, I couldn't sleep for excitement. We'll tell you who's going to win it. Hey, hey, with the Monkees. And they're back monkeying around with a new album and tour. We'll find out if they've still got something to say. And that's all coming right up after Bob Marley and the Wailers.
All right, we're jamming. I wanna jam it with you. We're jamming, jamming. And I hope you like jamming too. Ain't no rules, ain't no vow. We can do it anyhow. I and I will see you through. 'Cause every day we pay the price. We're the living sacrifice. Jamming till the jam is through. We're jamming.
As soon as we get a hint of summer, I roll out the old reggae compilations. And nothing exemplifies that summery feeling more than Bob Marley, a single from 1977, Jammin'. Hello, welcome to the Parish Council podcast, episode 260. Brought to you by the Media Motel. My name is Terence Stackham, and after a week off, which I suspect she dedicated to riotous living, it's Juliet Harris.
Hello, yes, there were things that happened. No, it was I had a grand old time in Spain, in the beautiful city of San Sebastian.
Ooh, lovely,
which I've never been to before, but I can thoroughly recommend to anybody that wants a nice holiday in the Basque region of Spain on the northwest coast. It was wonderful. People were very friendly, very nice place. Lots of nice food and drink. Three separate beaches, no less. So that was very, very good fun. It's nice to be back in England and have all of my worldly possessions not to be entirely coated in a fine film of sand. You know, that was not ideal, really. But no, first world problem. San Sebastian has more Michelin-style restaurants than anywhere else in the world.
And I rather think you
I went to one, took samples
from one of them.
Indeed. I didn't go to all of them. I went to one somewhere on the outskirts of San Sebastian. It was very much like being in a Bond film, actually, I must admit. So we had to get a taxi cab there. Just so that listeners know, I'm not a habitual person in Michelin star restaurants. It's the first one I've ever been to. It was very much an exciting sort of, I suspect, once in a lifetime trip for me. Yes. And we went exactly. Yes. Because usually people would associate me with the highest of lives. But anyway, we went to this cliff top location looking out onto a bay, and the whole thing, the lounge where you waited was basically bigger than my flat. And you went in, and there is a photograph which I may upload to social media channels of me wearing a black shirt, looking very much like a Bond villain, sat at a table in front of a thing. So yes, gin and tonic on a plate accompanied by gin and tonic was possibly my favourite of all of the courses, I think.
Well, that sounds good. Well, it's good to have you
it's
back.
It's very nice to be back. Things happened. You did your snazzy tunes and chat in my absence, which I very much enjoyed. If listeners have not caught up with Terence's special, please do. It is excellent.
I think I revealed too much, but it's too late. It's there now.
To be fair, at least you didn't have a 5-minute monologue about the time you nearly had a breakdown because you hated your job. So, you know, we're very much of the sharing things around these parts, aren't we? I'm the last person that needs to criticise you for oversharing. So, no, I for one welcome our new oversharing overlords. That's fine.
Jules, we referred to the situation related to Dr. Eva Carniero.
Yes, Dr. Eva, indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. Jose Mourinho and Chelsea Football Club. We've talked about it in passing before, but we've never looked at it in detail because of the time, the impending Employment Tribunal case. Well, the case was settled this week, as Employment Tribunals often seem to be, at the very last minute, on the steps, as the cliche goes. Despite that, the day before, Chelsea's lawyers were seeking stories to undermine Dr. Carniero. On the day of the hearing, however, Chelsea made a substantial financial offer. Yes. The club offered a full apology, and Mourinho stated his thanks for her work.
Yes.
Just a very, very brief synopsis in a sentence. During the first game of last season, referee called for Dr. Carniero and her colleague to come onto the pitch.
He's John Ferns, by the way, isn't he?
To treat Eden Hazard at Hazard's request. Mm. Mourinho went berserk, overreacting in a manner that would have shamed a toddler, and Dr. Carniero was sent into exile. Now, Jules, clearly a victory for the doctor, but does this reflect a wider problem with the way women are treated, whether or not they're high profile, in sport, media and business?
I think so, yes. And just to sort of, because I am a nerd and I am a lawyer, and often the two things go together, to concentrate just a brief comment on the circumstances of the offer. Now, I haven't done litigation for a few years, so apologies to all of the many litigation lawyers who I suspect are listening. This is out of date. But when I was doing litigation, when it came to trying to settle things before settle things out of court, you have effectively you end up with this bizarre kind of twin track correspondence where you're kind of, you know, boo, hiss, we hate you type litigation correspondence is the correspondence that goes on between the two parties, solicitors. And then you have this without prejudice correspondence, which if it's marked without prejudice, it does not go in front of the judge. So basically that's the bit behind the curtain where you're sort of both admitting the flaws in your cases and trying to find a way to come to an agreement. And the idea is that you can do that without the judge going, oh, well, you were trying to settle, so that shows you've got a flaw in your agreement. And there's very specific rules. If you make a Part 36 offer, so if someone makes you a Part 36 offer and you reject it, if you don't beat that offer when it comes to court, then there are huge cost implications usually. And so I don't know to what extent it was true. The reporting suggested that Eva Carniero may have received something in the region of £5 million for a settlement. Now, what was reported was that she was offered £1.2 million and turned it down, which suggests to me that that £5 million figure, if not accurate in £5 million, it's likely to be more than 1.2 million because otherwise any sensible, I mean, you don't generally advise a client to turn down a Part 36 offer unless, you know, you have to be pretty sure that you're going to be able to beat that in court. So that to me suggests that the fact that Chelsea were, you know, inclined to settle, the fact that Eva Carniero's lawyer said she could turn down a £1.2 million offer suggests to me that everyone was pretty sure that it was Chelsea that was in the wrong. Settling doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that you are holding your hands up and saying, sorry, governor. Sometimes it is, you know, tactical. But having said that, everything suggests to me that Chelsea knew that, you know, this problem is a Mourinho problem, wasn't it, really? And we said this all along. Having said that, though, you've said previously, as a Chelsea fan, which I find interesting, that, and to go back to the question you actually asked me about, you know, whether or not this is a wider problem. I think it is, in the sense that, and you've said, you would have had far more respect, even as a lifelong Chelsea supporter, for Chelsea if they had just booted Mourinho instantly.
Absolutely. And I felt it at the time and I still feel it.
Absolutely. And I think this is where you wonder if it is an institutional problem rather than just a sort of one bad apple rogue individual argument. Often you find this in firms. Middle management will misbehave. And curiously, although he is a manager of the Chelsea football team, as far as Chelsea Football Club is concerned, Mourinho is a middle manager, isn't he? Because he's not Abramovich and he's not a player. So he is in that organisation.
Yes, he's not a director. Exactly.
In that organisation, he's middle management. And often malfunctions tend to come at middle management level. And I've experienced this as well in working in firms. It's not the top of the problem. It's your immediate supervisor or a couple of levels above that that's the problem. And how strong that organisation is, how strong the management and the directors are at the top, depends on how they deal with middle management malfunctions. And the fact that Chelsea did not deal with the middle management malfunction, the fact that Chelsea throughout seemed to implicitly kind of roll their eyes at the fact that it was Mourinho that had done it, the fact that, you know, it was only Chelsea completely going to pieces on the pitch, which seemed, as we've always argued throughout, to perhaps to be indicative of the problem with Carniero and how that, you know, that kind of affected the whole club's morale, that was a failure of Chelsea's management at the top. And it does point to the idea that there is some kind of I think there are problems in institutions with dealing with malfunctioning middle management. And middle management, isn't it funny how it always seems to be minorities, quote unquote, so women or perhaps ethnic minorities or, you know, people that are disabled or want to work flexibly, that sort of thing. It always seems to be people with quote unquote weakness that middle managers try to seek out and make an example of. And actually, there's an excellent advert. I saw it last night. We'll go on to talk about the football later on, but there's an advert. The latest drink driving campaign is on, and they usually have a summer one and a Christmas one, don't they? And this is the summer one, and it shows a chap who I think is probably meant to be of a similar age to me, so, you know, sort of early 30s, born in 1980, mumble, and he's on a night out with a lot of men who are older than him, and they are his bosses. And there's a man with grey hair who's purported to be regional manager, and it's saying, "Oh, you want to impress your regional manager." And the regional manager offers the chap a drink that looks to be a whiskey or something, and says, "Do you want another drink?" And the chap goes, "Oh no, I've already had one. I'm driving. I can't have any more." And the manager starts to goad him. And the bloke stays clear and says, "No, I don't." And the voiceover says, "What do you do?" And the guy stays silent and says, "No, I'm not going to do it." At which point the manager starts to actively goad him into drinking, and he says, "No." And then they show him saying yes, and of course there's a massive crash and they all kind of fall across the bar. And he sticks with saying no. And then they say, "Oh, he's been sent to Siberia now and he's photocopying." And you see him photocopying and he looks up the camera and smiles, and they go, "Yeah, but he's still alive." And I think that's a spectacularly brave advert. I'm such a fan of this because it's not actually saying there aren't consequences to those decisions. But what it's saying is the ultimate consequence is that you're still alive. And I find this to be very interesting in this kind of concept, that if Chelsea had taken the decision and said, "No, Mourinho, we don't want another drink. Here's your bag. Off you go, mate," at an earlier point in time, I'm not saying no one would have died, but metaphorically, I think that they would have saved themselves an awful lot of time. And let's face it, money. In the long term than just taking the decision, which wasn't, I mean, I'm not saying it would have been an easy decision for Chelsea at all to make, to say, you know, "We've got this high profile successful manager, off you go, mate," but it would have taken a monumental stand against, you know, people using women and ethnic minorities and, you know, sort of weak people, quote unquote, or rather the vulnerable, as a convenient crutch, really. And in a way, I'm fed up with senior management not clamping down on this in organisations.
It was clear right at the time, as I said, and ever since, that Jose Mourinho was very much in the wrong. His behaviour, not for the first time in a football stadium, it has to be said, was abhorrent.
It's terrible. He also turned up randomly at the tribunal. Did you know this?
Yes, I did.
He rocked up one day and he wasn't meant to. Yeah, thanks for that.
It disturbs me that Chelsea were willing to indulge him, as you outlined, and pretend he was somehow to be defended, and they tried to run with the line that Dr. Carniero had done something wrong. But Mourinho is not the only senior figure of football to behave badly and to be indulged. You know, sort of iconic figures, Brian Clough and Sir Alex Ferguson, are just two men whose behaviour has often been overlooked and accommodated when what, you know, we might sort of call real life, it simply wouldn't be tolerated. We've got to a terrible point now in sport where men, of course, it's always men, are currently allowed to behave dreadfully for as long as they bring the owner the wealth or Champions League victories or Premiership titles, then they're indulged, as was shown here. And that's a really poor state of affairs. And it does also then reflect across into other aspects of life, because people look, you know, particularly people who are easily influenced will think, well, it's okay to walk, as long as you walk around with a swagger and you've got somebody with pots of money backing you, then you can just do whatever the hell you
like. And thinking about politics and the idea that men always have a longer lead than women, don't they? Men always have, you know, it always seems to be the case that men are indulged more than women. Ultimately, if you want things to make a difference to these hard-hearted, flinty male management types, I learnt this myself, the only way that you get people off your back, I tried to leave my nightmare firm a few years ago, and it was suggested / tried to be imposed upon me that I would stay on their payroll as a consultant. I said there was no way I wanted that to happen, not least because it would have completely, you know, banjaxed my tax position. The only way that I managed to persuade that bully of a boss that I was going to get off of the payroll and they weren't going to have me anymore was to say, all right then, I will stay on the payroll, but I will be charging what you're charging me out at, which is £230 plus VAT per hour, which I wasn't worth, by the way, but they were charging me out of that. And it was only at that point that I made it cost them money that he then went, oh, let's not trouble Juliet anymore because this is how much she's charging. I was removed from the payroll and I flew away into the night, literally cackling on train. And actually, in a way, I wonder if this might turn out to be a tipping point. It might not, but the fact that it has cost Chelsea reportedly £5 million, when in fact just dumping Mourinho, weathering the storm of 2 or 3 months and then coming out the other side, if you make it cost people money, rather tragically, that's often what changes people's minds. So it'd be interesting to see whether or not that makes a difference.
Yes, indeed. Euro 2016, not the referendum.
No, hooray.
But the International Football Tournament. It's here and we're going to tell you which team is going to win it right after The Prisoners.
Thank you.
Peppers and Melanie. They're pretty much their only hit single dating from the mod revival period of the late 70s, early 80s. I picked that because when I went to this Medway Legends weekend thing in Spain, which is what I was doing there, Graham Day and the Forefathers, Graham Day being a former prisoner, headlined on the second night and were excellent, and they played this as an encore, and there was much revelry to be had. So, yes, it was nice. In a way, it was a peculiar experience for me because, of course, I love all that mod that people know from the Saturday Social. I love all that mod stuff. But it was very peculiar to be, and again, apologies for any offences causes the listeners, it was very peculiar for me to be enjoying this period of a time before, I was reminiscing about a time which happened before I was born, yet somehow it seemed to work in its own way. So yeah, big fan of that tune. It was, and also they were, you know, they played excellently. They rolled back the years.
I imagine so. Now, Jules, there's always something of the element of a phony war as we run up to a major yeah. football tournament. You know, we analyse rather meaningless friendlies and seek out any snippets of injuries or discord from the team camps. Now, we're recording this on the morning of Saturday, 11th of June.
That we are, yes.
So we've only had one match in the European Championships. That was last night. France beat Romania 2-1.
With
a last-minute winner.
Yes, and that rather ruined my fun, really, because I predicted 5 minutes in when it was nil-all that the match would end 1-1. That was my prediction. And I was watching it with my parents, and I was just 88. My mum had said, once France had gone 1-0 up, it won't be 1-0. And I said, yes, it will. And then Romania got a penalty, and I was jubilant that it was 1-0. And I was literally mid-boast 88 minutes in about how wonderful it was that I predicted, at which point France scored that rather spectacular second goal. And by Payet, it was Payet, wasn't it, that scored?
Yeah, the West Ham player.
Beautiful goal. And then I had to endure the last 4 minutes of being told off. Pride comes before a fall, and such other statements were thrown at me.
Similarly, my sister texted me when France were leading 1-0, boasting that she had that score in her sweepstake. And as she sent it, Romania equalised, and she followed it up with a text going,
out to everybody who's in a sweepstake. When we'll talk now about our runners and riders, I will tell you who I've got in the sweepstake. We can analyse whether our Twitter sweepstake, I mean, whether or not that will end well or not. I suspect the latter will apply, but we can discuss it.
The one thing we do know is that a team is going to have to be pretty poor not to make it to the knockout stages. These group fixtures are only going to reduce the numbers from 24 to 16.
Yes.
So at this point, looking at the groups, and it's probably fair to say that from the home countries, Northern Ireland have a tough task. They're facing Germany, Poland and the Ukraine.
Yeah, I can't see them finishing anything other than last in that group, although I really wish them well.
England should get through. Wales might, but our close pals, the Republic of Ireland, they might find it tricky because they're in a group with Belgium, Italy and Sweden. That's not going to be easy. But yeah. Jules, you and I have a terrific record in predicting the outcome.
Famously excellent. Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, tell me, which team is going to win Euro 2016?
I think probably France is my feeling, because they looked pretty good last night. A bit shaky at the back, perhaps. The central defenders they played were sort of an untried and tested combination. Having said that, the fact that they have Giroud, Payet and Pogba, who I think could rightly feel aggrieved for being taken off last night, because although they did go on to win, Payet and Pogba seem to be a match made in heaven, really. So home advantage. You know, I think France seemed fairly strong. The Guardian, I read through the Guardian's football pundits' predictions. There were about 10 or 12 of them, I think, that were predicting things. And yes, their record last season was as good as ours in terms of the Premiership. And they all kind of said, the chap that predicted that England might get to the final justified it by saying, well, let's face it, it's no madder than Leicester winning the Premier League. But most of those pundits, they didn't ask them who'd win, but they said who would get through to the final. France, Germany and Spain were by far and away kind of the most predictions, with Italy as kind of outsiders. It's hard to see past any of those four, really. I mean, the top three being France, Germany and Spain, probably in that order for me. Germany are technically better than France, but I think that home advantage is a very potent thing. It will get you so far. And I think that the combination of home advantage and France's talent will push them over the top. Spain, it's hard to say. You know, they were brilliant and then all of a sudden they weren't. And Italy are probably the best of the dark horse outsiders, I think, really. Or rather, you know, the sort of the B tier down, I think. That's probably my feeling. I think France or Germany. I don't know how the draw works. I do have my Radio Times war chart up, but I'm not entirely sure how the draw falls. But France.
It's terribly complicated with this thing about the third place teams. That puts it all into you can't figure out who's going to face whom, because it depends on which of the four of the six groups, the four best third place teams in the six groups.
It's confusing, isn't it? Yeah. It's a bit like Eurovision, where every country's allowed to vote, even though not all of them have got through to the final. I would love it if they did it like Eurovision, and we had to sit through 3 hours of people from the Faroe Islands going, hello France, will you give 10 points to Iceland? And everyone goes, oh, they always give 10 points to Iceland. It would be lovely if they did it like that, I think. So that's my top tip for the Euro organisers.
Who did you get in your sweep? Did you get France in your sweep as well?
I got Poland in my sweep.
Poland
actually,
in your sweep.
Which I can't see. I can't see that ending in a winning. Who was in their group again? It was.
I don't know. Germany, Poland, Ukraine, and Northern Ireland.
I could see them doing a third place in that possibly, and then it depends upon how well they've done and all that sort of thing. My Facebook feed was full of various friends of mine crowing that they had France in their respective sweepstakes. So it's interesting actually that the general feeling seems to be that France might be the ones that win. So
we're going to be of an accord here. I think Leicester City have proved that anything
absolutely
can happen.
Absolutely, and on that logic, Iceland will win. I think
you say that on my bullet points here. I've got Iceland as my outsiders. So they're my outside bet. But France are my pick to win the tournament, maybe beating Spain or Italy in the final. Although I really hope the home teams do well, I can't see any of them getting beyond the quarterfinals. But do you know what, Jules? The thing that Roy Hodgson troubles me. Talking about England, he comes over to me. I'd be interested in your view on this. He comes over to me as a man way out beyond his depth in the modern game. I know he's had success. You know, he managed Switzerland. Oh, when was that? You know, 33 years ago.
Inter Milan, again in the 90s at some point.
He's a permanently tetchy man. He's defensive with the media. And he seems intent on making the huge mistake. This is repeated over and over in tournaments, of shoehorning players into the team in order to accommodate these players he somehow seems in awe of. And as a result, you know, that playing Vardy and Kane out on the two touch lines, as he did in that last friendly, anyway, we've got a full month of all the hijinks that a tournament brings. And I also just wanted to say, let's hope it's memorable for all the right reasons, looking at some of the news coming out of Marseille overnight.
Absolutely. And my friends said it's hysterical with England because it's not like we're even any good anyway, is it? So, speaking of my sort of predictions England-wise, I agree with you. I think if England fail at this tournament, Hodgson has got to go, because there's been no... I like Roy Hodgson, actually. I have a bit more time for Roy Hodgson than you do, but there's been no progress at all, has there? It's almost a bit like Ed Miliband leading the Labour Party. We're sort of waiting for the great leap forward, aren't we? And all the signs seem quite positive, and all the talk seems quite positive, and, you know, we're trying new things, and nothing ever seems to work. I think that, like you say, I think it's a failure of management. It's a failure of decision-making, I think. And you say about him being in awe of players. He just doesn't seem to be able to say, look, we have five strikers that are excellent. Isn't that good? We were in a similar position probably in Euro 96, I would say, except Terry Venables found a way of not playing all his strikers. He found a way of saying, you know,
we had Shearer and Sheringham. They were the best two strikers. Let's play them.
Exactly.
That was it.
We had other people like Fowler, you know, who perhaps in another year might have, you know, to some extent, as a football player, you have to, like in any walk of life, you have to accept luck, don't you, really? You have to accept whether or not your destiny is often dependent upon whether you're born at the right time or not. Andy Murray in tennis has the, you know, probably would have won a lot more majors had he not had the misfortune to live in the era of Federer, Nadal and Djokovic, who, and again, this is why I think men's tennis has been, you know, phenomenal for the last 10 to 15 years, because at what other point in history have there been people with those levels of talent all competing at the same time? And I, you know, I think, I hope history will judge Murray to be a better player than perhaps, you know, he's won majors than perhaps his record suggests, because he was sort of unlucky to be born at the wrong time, I think, really. And there are some England players at the moment who would probably walk into any other England side. You know, I think that the embarrassment of riches England have up front really is just incredible. Guess what? You can't play everyone. And I think I am, like a lot of people, concerned by Roy Hodgson's squad selection. I know that you can only work with what you've got, and that perhaps, you know, it points to deficiencies in the FA's training system and development squads. But, you know, he's picked, so rather than thinking I need to pick a balanced team, he's picked all the good strikers, and the defence is makeshift at best, isn't it, really, at times? And it is.
And, you know, I think we're one game away, you know, from him doing something absolutely crazy. Like, so, for example, if Dele Alli starts playing well in the number 10 role, and I'm sure in the back of his mind he'll think, oh, it's too embarrassing. I, dear old Wayne, I've got to pick Wayne. And I think we're only one game away from him saying to Joe Hart, look, Joe, you've been a great server for England, but, you know, Wayne's got to play. Yeah. So, you know, Wayne's got the gloves.
And actually,
I think
they were right to take him, in that I think in a squad that young, it is good to have some older heads around. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to build the team around your older head. And I mean, I'm an enormous admirer of Wayne Rooney as a player, and actually increasingly as a person, actually. I think he's actually, for someone that's always been painted as a bit of a lad and has had, you know, experiences and reported experiences, I think he's quite, weirdly, I never thought I'd ever say this about Wayne Rooney, but weirdly, he's quite dignified nowadays in the way that he conducts himself. And I admire that. And actually, I think that probably he would have taken it all right, I think, had he been told, sorry, Wazza, you know, it's not, God's sake, I'm sorry, it's not really happening. But yeah, so like you say,
whoever would have thought we'd get to a stage where Wayne Rooney would be the elder statesman?
I know. It, what can I say? What a world we're living in, Terence. What a world.
It's 51 years since this advertisement appeared in Daily Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. I quote, madness, auditions, folk and roll musician singers for acting roles in new TV series, running parts for four insane boys aged 17 to 21. Once spirited Ben Franks types, have courage to work, must come down for interview, end of quote. 437 boys applied, from whom Davy Jones, Peter Tork, Michael Nesmith and Mickey Dolenz were chosen. We'll be looking at 50 years of the Monkees right after this splendid track from Carl Blau.
If you love somebody enough, you'll follow wherever they go. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. If you love somebody enough, wants to go. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. I know if you've seen her, you tell me, 'cause you are my friend. I've got to find her and find out the trouble she's in. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. She would get mad and she used to say she would come back to Memphis someday. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. I haven't eaten a bite or slept for 3 days and nights. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. I've got to find her, tell her that I love her soul. to crying. That's how I got to Memphis. 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 Got to Memphis.
From a tiny village on a small island in the Pacific Northwest, the multi-talented Carl Blau and his splendid cover of an old Bobby Bear song from the 1970s, That's How I Got to Memphis. Carl Blau is playing several dates in the UK in a couple of months.
Yes, including my hometown of Hastings, which I think I might have to amble down, I think.
Yeah, it's about 8 dates across the UK, including the Lexington in London and, indeed, your next door to you, Jules, in on the South
indeed,
Coast.
Indeed, yes.
Jules, when I heard that the Monkees were releasing a new album in 2016, I have to confess that I thought that more of them were no longer with
yes.
us. when in fact, it's only poor Davy Jones who's missing. He died in 2012.
Which makes me, just to go on a very brief side tangent, I used to write, and I do occasionally write for a TV blog called Pause Live Action, and my favourite ever post on this was when someone talked about someone who they thought had died and had not, and then this prompted a sort of a chain of comments underneath, and the blog post was called something along the lines of, "You'll never guess who's not dead." And actually, Davy Jones, ironically, some of the people featured in that blog have since died, I think. But yes, I've spent years insisting that Stanley Baxter is no longer with us, and he very much is, apparently. So yes, several nominees for You'll Never Guess Who's Not Dead there, I think.
Over the years since 1965, there have been several reunions of the Monkees in various guises, usually not with all the members participating.
No.
Mike Nesmith was often unwilling to cooperate.
Presumably busy living off the proceeds of his mother's invention of Tippex.
Indeed, he didn't need the money. You're absolutely right. But here we are, it's 2016, and all three living members of the group appear on this new album called Good Times. And indeed, Davy Jones appears on one track from Beyond the Grave, obviously re-recording a track before he passed
yes.
on. Before we talk about it, let's hear a 30-second clip from one of the songs. Most of the tracks have been contributed by well-known songwriters. Here's a clip from track 2, written by Andrew Partridge of XTC. This is You Bring the Summer.
I'll bring the chips and the dips and root beer, even though dark purple rain clouds are near. When you come around, you bring the summer.
Yes, Jules, pop stars seem to be the one category in life where no one ever retires. We have the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, Ringo, The Who, Dylan, all out on tour. Indeed, the Monkees are supporting this album with a 50-day tour of America. But here's the question. Is this new album any good?
I thought it was all right, actually. I mean, I've only listened to it once all the way through. When we were coming back from Spain, we drove back. Our flight landed at 11:15 in the evening on a Sunday night, which meant by the time we got through baggage and unfortunately my friends who had parked the car weren't able instantly to remember which bay we were in. And of course, there was a choice of 26 being through the alphabet A to Z. Eventually, it was discovered that it was F through a very helpful bus driver that rang up sort of centrally. And we now, through working out what time we'd arrived, they managed to place where we were. I wasn't with them on the upwards journey. Otherwise, I'd have had it tattooed to my person. So the answer was F, fortunately. So we didn't have to go around every bay. But we drove down through the night as a result of which. And so we heard Janice Long. And otherwise known as The Truckers Show, I think. And it was very interesting that she played a lot of trucking type songs. And she played a song from the new Monkees album and said, oh, that was the Monkees. And the driver of our car said, oh, is that the Monkees? That was really the Monkees. I went, yeah, they've got a new album out. And he went, what? That's new. And I went, yeah, that's new. So there is a general kind of disbelief that the Monkees are producing new music. I think my thoughts on the Monkees album reflect my thoughts on pop star comeback / never going aways generally, which is, I thought it was fine. I thought it was a good record. I didn't think it was as life-changingly brilliant as their 60s stuff, although having said that, I've only heard it once. So who knows, maybe the 60s stuff is brilliant because it's borne the test of time. So it's difficult to tell if something is great at the time. Maybe 10 years later, if it's still great, that's an all-time great, isn't it? So I don't know. I thought it was fine. I thought it was as good as anything I've heard recently. In a way, that was its biggest failing, really. I didn't think it was spectacularly great. You know, it did the job. I thought it was all right. You know, it was a good record in its own right. Funnily enough, that Andy Partridge number I thought was one of the better ones. It was okay. I can't. The problem is that I can't build up that much enthusiasm about it, really.
I'm similar. to me, the new album. The thing that struck me was the Andy Partridge track sounds like Mickey Dolenz singing with XTC.
It does, yes.
There's a track written by Noel Gallagher and Paul Weller that sounds like Nesmith and Dolenz singing with Oasis. So, you know, I say good luck to the Monkees and I hope they're all having fun and making a few dollars, but I can't really see or hear the point of this album. And
in fairness, when you talk about people contributing songs to people's albums, this is not necessarily isolated to the Monkees. Marianne Faithfull had an album a few years ago. I'm struggling to remember the name of that now, but she had various... She had various collaborators that helped her, that wrote songs. And I think PJ Harvey wrote a few songs for that album. Nick Cave contributed a number. Damon Albarn did a number. And Before the Poison is what it's called. And it was released in 2005. And yeah, so you had it was basically PJ Harvey and co that helped to produce it. And it was, you know, we have various Marianne Faithfull numbers, a Damon Albarn number, a Nick Cave number, several PJ Harvey numbers and a John Bryan number. And I have to say that if you didn't know whose track was who and you listened, you could almost get 100% record, because they very much, I mean, she, you know, Marianne Faithfull sang, but they all very much sounded like the people that had written them. The PJ Harvey numbers sounded much like PJ Harvey, to the point where one of them was actually on a PJ Harvey album. The Damon Albarn, you know, again, you know, PJ Harvey, obviously high occurrence of Jesus, Rivers, Women and Death, and Nick Cave again, sort of Death and Women and Flowers and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's not an uncommon occurrence.
No, it's a kind of feeling of like riding on the coattails of more successful contemporary people. I did watch an old episode of the Monkees on YouTube.
You?
I think they're all on there. Yeah, and it was only 20 minutes long because of all the ads on American TV, and I kind of enjoyed it. I wouldn't watch the whole, you know, all of their series for like 3 or 4 years, but it was cute to watch in the way that it's funny to watch old Batman episodes from the mid 60s.
Yes. I have played in bands in front of projections of those before, and they are fun, to be fair.
It's sort of really endemic of its time, and I think that though encapsulates the issue, because I think it's true that at this stage of the careers of heritage acts, fans really only want to hear the hits. And here's an example. I saw Ray Davies of the Kinks in Hyde Park a couple of years ago, a really lovely warm summer's evening, those gigs that now take place in Hyde Park in the summer. And I witnessed this point really starkly, because as soon as Ray Davies said, ladies and gentlemen, here's Waterloo Sunset, the crowd
bonkers,
went mad. Everybody up on their feet. When he said, "I'd like to play you a new song now,"
Stampede,
everybody
to the bar, yes.
Everybody sat down, returned to their picnic or glass of wine. And I think this new Monkees album, it's cheery and pleasant, but few fans would pick any of these tracks over Daydream Believer or Last Train to Clarksville or those, you know, the classic hits.
It's true. And
that's the problem.
And that's true. And I'm planning, I haven't bought tickets yet, but there's a festival in Brighton the weekend of the 3rd and 4th September called Together the People. And the headline act on the Saturday night is Brian Wilson.
Oh, Lord,
I know, exactly. And it's 2 days after my birthday, so I will probably be going. And again, like you, I'm going. I mean, it's basically, it's 50 years of Pet Sounds is the tour. And that's why I'm going, because I have little interest in Brian Wilson's new material as much as I admire him. But
exactly.
I might have an opportunity to see him do Pet Sounds again. And I initially didn't go because I didn't want it to be, you know, like you say, a sort of a slight return. Although I know someone, he's done a few dates recently, and someone went to a Welsh date who I'm pals with on Facebook. And it basically said, go. Don't worry, go. It's really, really, really good. So in a way, whilst the Monkees, in a way, it's sort of new material. It sort of justifies your existence to do a money making a nostalgia tour, really, doesn't it? That's it's hard to shake that assumption that, you know,
exactly,
that yes, isn't it good they've got a new album, but they've got an excuse to tour and play the hits. And I suppose in a way, perhaps if you're an artist, it makes you feel a little bit better about the fact that people only ever want to hear your own material. You can kid yourself that people want to hear your new material by coming on tour, but really they're just there for the hits.
Absolutely, and I think they'll find this. The Monkees on their 50-date US tour. I think it'll be the Ray Davies experience again. It'll be, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a believer. Everybody goes nuts. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a track that Andy Partridge wrote for us for our new album. Everybody's right. Yeah, okay.
Brace yourselves at the bar. Yeah, exactly.
You can contact us if you wish. The best way to do so is through Twitter. It's the easiest, most direct route. At SuperJules84.
Hooray.
At Sir Terence.
Hooray!
Jules, I understand breaking news that you have got public appearances on the horizon.
Yes, breaking news. We're recording this on Saturday, the 11th of June. If you are listening on Saturday, the 11th of June, why don't you pop yourself in a car or on a train, come down to Hastings for the weekend, probably, have a lovely look round, or if you just want to come for the Saturday, you can do that, because I'm appearing at the Dragon Bar with my pal Letty as Sheila's Take a Bow. We will be doing some tunes and having a little shuffle about. Probably from about 8-ish until about 11-ish, so you still have time for the last train, I think, back to London. Come and waddle on the pier in the day, do that. We're spinning tunes in the Dragon Bar in Hastings Old Town, George Street. Other non-public appearances, no Saturday social this week, but back next week. And hopefully, now that I have rid my computer of the pox that is Windows 10, we will have Indie Wonderland live next week on Barricade Radio, barricaderadio.com, 8 to 10 p.m.
Huge thanks to Rona, whose contribution can never be underestimated.
Rona weeks are always happy weeks for me.
Absolutely. And thanks to you for listening very much. Thank you. We'll be back next week, but we're finishing on an ecclesiastical note.
Yes,
Jules.
Indeed. Well, as it is the parish council, it's occasionally good to remind ourselves of that. And actually, this feeds in nicely to our conversation we've just been having about old things. And this is something that puts a new slant on something old. There was a cult garage rock band in the 60s called The Monks, who were all apparently American GIs, or most of them. And they were, you know, really quite a kind of misanthropic in their view of the world. Some people, including a couple of pals of mine, various sort of survivors from various different kind of riot girl 90s groups, got together and formed a band called Ye Nuns, which is an all-female tribute band to the Monks. The woman, the sort of main shaker behind them, Lolo, she also runs increasingly popular all-female Duran Duran tribute, Joanne, who plays sometimes in London, who won't do I don't know, they wouldn't do certain songs, but I think they do Hungry Like the Wolf now. They are excellent. They're really worth watching. And Ye Nuns, they feature Debbie Smith, formerly of Curve and Echo Belly. She plays the banjo. There are two Debbies. One plays drums as well, so that was formerly in the Head Coatees. So they are Bongo Debbie and Banjo Debbie. They all call themselves sisters. So there is Sister Lolo and Sisters Charlie Stone, formerly of Gay Dad. They are a phenomenal experience. They're playing at Beatwave Festival in Hastings on the 22nd to the 24th of July. So I would thoroughly recommend going to see them. I've been having them in my car for my commute back to work post holiday this week, and I found this song to be a great comfort at times. So so putting a brand new innovative spin on something that was previously very old. This is the Ye Nuns, as they're known, and I Hate You.
You have been listening to a DAKAM Media production.